The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. Okay, so the first question I have to ask you all is, are you hungry? No, because it's right after lunch. And as I was reading Victor Serge's Year One of the Russian Revolution, I realized that everything that was done in Russia in that year was done under conditions of mass and persistent hunger. So it occurred to me to ask the conference organizers to put a note in the schedule asking people to fast before they came. But then I decided that was kind of loopy, so I dropped it. However, I want you to keep in mind as you listen to me how hunger might affect your perception of events and the actions that you take in dealing with them. Because that was what was going on then and there. So last year, I gave 3 talks to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. And at the end of the 3rd talk, which was in San Diego, are there any San Diego people here? Okay, it will be different. Some things will be the same. I was asked by an audience member why I hadn't mentioned Stalin. And I will say now, as I said then, that that is a different talk. And most of you should have gotten a handout when you walked in. If you want to learn about Stalin, I have a talk about that too. Email me and I'll send it to you. I'm happy to do that. But I won't have time to talk about Stalin in this talk. And my talk will be too long anyway, which shouldn't surprise anyone who has heard me speak before. So let's get started. I want you to start off by turning to your neighbor and talking for 2 minutes about what you know about the Russian Revolution. And if you're not sure about what you know, then you can talk about that. And I'll tell you when your time is up. Thank you. Okay, so on October 25th, 1917, according to the calendar that was in use at that time, the Bolshevik Party led an insurrection that removed the ineffective, unpopular, and counter-revolutionary provisional government from power and transferred all power to the Soviets. Soviets were workers' councils and peasants' councils and soldiers' councils. This represents the first and only time in world history that working-class people have attempted to rule in their own interest, making it the most important day in working-class history, which might make you wonder, why is the ISO one of the few organizations that celebrates it? The answer is simple. Because the revolution represents the first and only time the working class has taken power, capitalists all over the world have a vested interest in erasing and distorting its history. Raise your hand if you have heard any of these common misconceptions about the Russian Revolution. Number one, the Russian Revolution was a coup accomplished by a tiny group of close conspirators. Number two, the Russian Revolution destroyed the Russian economy and led to starvation and mass suffering. Number three, the political philosophy of its leadership, particularly Lenin, produced the rise of Stalin and made it so that, like all revolutions that attempt to end hunger and want and achieve freedom and equality, it instead led to greater oppression and violence. Finally, number four, the Russian Revolution was a mistake. It should never have been tried. Okay, so that's pretty much all of them. Now, obviously, if these things are true, we might still want to study the Russian Revolution, mostly to see what not to do, but we wouldn't be looking to it as a shining example of what working class people can accomplish when they're united, organized, and committed to achieving socialism. But that is exactly how I think we should see it, and as such, I have 2 goals for this talk. The first one is to lay out a timeline through which I hope to dispel those misconceptions, and then the second one is to inspire you to study the Russian Revolution. Right above my email on the handout, which you hopefully got, but if you didn't, borrow one from a neighbor, there's a list of books, and I hope to convince you to buy at least one of them, read it, and then pass it on to someone who wants change as much as you do. This talk is largely based on this book, Year One of the Russian Revolution. As you can see, it is quite thick. Okay, so I'm not going to be able to cover it all today. So you should read it yourself, because it's an amazing book. All right, so with the starting with the timeline. The first phase of the Russian Revolution is completed in February of 2017 when Tsar Nicholas II abdicates his throne. This occurs after weeks of strikes and demonstrations against the conditions produced by Russia's involvement in World War I, which had already done the work of destroying the Russian economy. Russian troops, poorly armed, often without boots, suffered devastating losses on all fronts, leading 1.5 million soldiers to desert in 1916 alone. The country's levels of production have been pushed back hundreds of years, People are starving. They wait in massive lines in sub-zero temperatures for hours to get a few ounces of bread. The two factions of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, call for strikes in the city of St. Petersburg for various reasons and at various times. And first tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of workers answer that call, demanding peace, bread, and an end to the Tsar's rule. Striking workers fraternize with ordinary soldiers and even Cossacks, who were richer soldiers who owned their own horses and had land but still had a beef with the Tsar. The Tsar orders all demonstrations banned. The police arrest 100 revolutionary leaders and soldiers open fire on strikers, killing 150 and injuring more than 1,000. The soldiers of the 4th Company of the Pavlovsky Regiment, outraged that part of their regiment fired on workers, revolt and they get into a firefight with the police. Company after company joins the mutiny. They storm an arsenal, liberate political prisoners, and plot to kill their commanders. Meanwhile, in the halls of government, two different dynamics are going on. On the one hand, members of the Russian Duma, or parliament, decide to form a provisional committee, later to become the provisional government, and ask the Tsar to share power with a prime minister, which the Tsar refuses to do. He wasn't that bright. At the same time, councils of workers and soldiers have formed and come together in the St. Petersburg Soviet, that is, a council in which all the organized workers and soldiers in the city are represented. Within 2 weeks, the Soviet comprises 3,000 representatives, a majority of them Mensheviks and another political party, the Socialist Revolutionaries, which primarily represent the peasants who made up 80% of the population at the time. A similar series of events unfolds in Moscow. The Tsar's ministers are arrested and the Provisional Committee attempts to take charge of the army. However, to do so, the Provisional Committee must compete with the Soviets, who are also at work among the soldiers. And the first joint plenum of the Soviet of Workers and Soldiers Deputies mandates that all garrisons elect soldiers' committees to represent them in the soldiers' Soviet and accept orders only from the Soviet and from their local committees. The St. Petersburg Soviet and the Duma discuss the formation of a new government. And then finally, on March the 2nd, Nicholas II abdicates, ending 300 years of autocratic rule by the Romanov dynasty. Trump has been in office for a year and a half. Imagine what that would be like. Well, imagine what that has been like. Think about what that has been like, and then multiply it by 200. Okay, so that's the Romanov dynasty. Only probably it was much worse. And it was for 300 years. So it's over. And that's a big thing to take in. Now, up to this point, the revolution is fairly non-controversial. In maintaining a feudal autocracy that is an economy based on agriculture and a government based on the divine right of kings, Russia is behind the rest of the capitalist world. All but the most reactionary think that the Tsar's time is up. In fact, the US recognizes the new government, the provisional government, within a week, followed closely by France and England. It's what happens next that the dominant capitalist worldview finds offensive. The situation that I have just described, with the provisional government and the Soviets both attempting to rule Russia, is an example of dual power. The provisional government and the Soviets are, that is, neither body has complete control of the situation. The provisional government and the Soviets are not only two very different forms of government, they serve the interests of very different classes. The provisional government knows that the class it represents is a minority, so sometimes it takes actions that clearly serve the interests of the workers and peasants that make up the majority. They have to in order to keep any grasp on power. For example, on March 6th, it declares an amnesty for all political prisoners. On March 12th, it repeals the death penalty. And on April 12th, it grants freedom of assembly and legalizes unions. In other areas, however, the provisional government directly serves the interests of the ruling class. For example, it refuses to grant independence to Finland or Poland. Instead of redistributing the land, it condemns and punishes land seizures by poor peasants. But most critically, the provisional government demonstrates no intention to end the war. At first, it declares that the war has to be continued to protect the revolution. Then a secret memo is leaked revealing that it intends to continue the war and annex new territory. And finally, one of its leaders, Alexander Kerensky, goes on a speaking tour announcing a new offensive. Writing about this speaking tour, Kerensky admits that his government has lost control of the army. He says, "For the sake of the nation's life, it was necessary to restore the army's will to die." His words to the soldiers on the front lines were as follows: "I summon you not to a feast, but to death." really inspiring stuff. Now, you'll remember, it was specifically to get out of the war that the people of Russia took down the Tsar. And it is most acutely because of the provisional government's betrayal of that promise that when Lenin returns from exile, which he can do because the provisional government declared amnesty for political prisoners, he begins trying to win the Bolshevik Party to the position of all power to the Soviets. That is to end the situation of dual power and bring all the power into the hands of the workers' and soldiers' councils. He argues that the contradictions inherent in sharing power with members of the capitalist class can only continue at the expense of the goals of the revolution: peace, land, and bread. Bread signifying the fact that there's no food and people are really hungry. Over the next weeks and months, this argument is won first in the Bolshevik Party, then in the Soviets, and then among the masses, who become tired of the speechifying inaction and retrograde action of the provisional government, as well as the refusal of the Menshevik and socialist revolutionary-led Soviets to take power. In July, Kerensky's new military offensive collapses, costing tens of thousands of lives, and the workers in St. Petersburg revolt. The Bolsheviks argue for restraint. In St. Petersburg, the country's capital, workers have been won to the necessity of Soviet power, but this is not true in the rest of the country. If they start the revolution in St. Petersburg at this time, they'll be able to seize power, but they won't be able to hold it. And despite the fact that the Bolshevik Party acts to contain the revolution at this point, the provisional government orders the arrest of its leaders and bans its newspaper. Now, you'll remember that I said that all but the most reactionary folks agree that the Tsar's time was up. Well, one of the pro-Tsar reactionary folks is a general named Lavr Kornilov. I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name. It's on the handout, Lavr. The provisional government, now led by Kerensky, does a few other things besides arresting Bolsheviks. Not only do they authorize military trials at the front and reinstate the death penalty, but they also allow Kornilov to become Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the Army. This turns out to be a fatal mistake for the provisional government. Kornilov wants to reverse the gains of the revolution and attempts a coup. Kerensky goes along with Kornilov at first and asks him to send cavalry to St. Petersburg to institute martial law. But then when he finds out that Kornilov means to attack the provisional government, he calls him a traitor. But at that point, there's not much he can do about it. Fortunately, in the meantime, the Bolsheviks had begun organizing the workers and soldiers of Petrograd to defend their city and the revolution. 40,000 workers form Red Guards, while railway workers destroy the train tracks to prevent Kornilov's troops from reaching the city. Kornilov is defeated, and the provisional government has demonstrated its utter bankruptcy. Instead of ending the war or redistributing land, it plays footsie with a reactionary. All over the country, the mood in the Soviets shifts decisively in favor of taking power. A few days later, the Bolsheviks win majorities in both the Petersburg and the Moscow Soviets. A month later, in October 12th, the Petersburg Soviet, now the Petrograd Soviet, so as to sound less German, forms the Military Revolutionary Committee, specifically designed to lead an insurrection. A week later, on October 19th, the All-Russian Conference of Factory and Shop Committees adopts the slogan, "All Power to the Soviets." Less than a week after that, Red Guards and Soviet workers control all roads into the city, the General Post Office, three major train stations, the State Bank, the Central Telephone Exchange, the power stations, and the main government buildings. And at 10:40 p.m. on October 25th, the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets opens. The Bolsheviks win a majority of the leadership, and the Mensheviks and Socialist Revolutionaries walk out because they oppose the seizure of power and they don't want to work with a Bolshevik majority. So 50 or so delegates take their toys and go home, and the Congress proceeds without them. The Winter Palace, where the provisional government had its headquarters, is captured at 2 a.m. on October 26th. Kerensky is already gone, having fled to the north the day before. The Soviets have taken power, and now they must figure out what to do with it. Now I want to, so in this section I'm going to cover three things. The Great Decrees, because I'm going to be talking about what they did once they had power. So now they've got it. What do they do with it? So the first thing is the Great Decrees. The second is the transformation of education, because I know there are a lot of educators in the ISO, and I thought there might be interest in that. And finally, acts of sabotage committed by the capitalist class and its supporters, including the biggest act of sabotage of all, which is the Civil War, which precipitates single-party rule and the Red Terror. Now, the slogan that brought about the February Revolution, demand for peace, land, and bread, represented the things that the Tsar and the capitalist ruling class quite demonstratively could not and would not provide to the working class and poor peasants of Russia. Consequently, satisfying these demands was the first order of business when the Soviets took power in October. Victor Serge, in year one of the Russian Revolution, notes what was at stake for the fledgling government. I quote, "If it hesitates or fools itself, if what it proclaims does not chime in with the masses' longings, all will be lost tomorrow. The delegates must find the words that can conquer, vote the decrees which will win for the revolution, the embittered people of the trenches, the impatient people of the countryside, and the people of the cities. Please keep these words in mind. The new government must win for the revolution the embittered people of the trenches, that is, the soldiers, poorly outfitted and dying in large numbers and in awful ways on the battlefields of World War I. The soldiers, as much as the Bolsheviks, made the revolution possible. Also note that taking power is one thing and holding it is another. It's not a static enterprise. The Soviet government must not only find the right words, but take the right actions to maintain the confidence of the masses. Appropriately then, the decree on peace is the first to be passed, and it reads, quote, the workers' and peasants' government established by the revolution of 24-25 October and based on the Soviets invites all the belligerent nations and their governments to open negotiations without delay for a just and democratic peace. Passing this decree does not immediately end the war, and the peace that was eventually made was not the just and democratic peace that the Soviets were hoping for. But imagine that you're a soldier, hungry, cold, brutalized by your commanders, kept at the front on pain of death. Perhaps for the first time in your life, you've rebelled and participated in the seizure of power. You want to know, did I do the right thing? Are things going to get better? And then the new government, the government that you and others like you helped to bring into being, does the one thing that everybody wants. It begins the process of withdrawing from the war, something the provisional government wasn't even trying to do. The decree on peace also abolishes secret diplomacy and treaties, so from now on you, a common soldier, will know exactly what your government is doing and why. Imagine the boost to your confidence, and imagine the increase in your loyalty to the new regime. Some of the actors in the Soviet, specifically the left socialist revolutionaries or left SRs, think the decree is too soft. They think it should include threats and ultimatums. Lenin replies that given the exhausted state of the army, such threats would be empty unless the government could compel the soldiers to fight, which he argues should not at this point be their aim. He writes, and this is quoting Lenin, the only government which the bourgeoisie recognizes as strong is one which can use all the power of the state machine to push the masses anywhere it pleases. Our conception of strength is different. In our eyes, a government is strong in proportion to the consciousness of the masses. It is strong when these masses know everything, judge everything, accept everything consciously. The decree on peace also included an appeal to the workers of France, Britain, and Germany. Dedicate yourselves to your own liberation and that of the world working class. So from the very start, the new government is internationalist in nature. The second great decree is the decree on land. Its first section reads as follows. The landowner's rights of ownership over the soil is abolished forthwith without compensation. Again, imagine yourself as a soldier. Most of the soldiers were peasants. The new government has just declared an armistice, and while you're not sure how all that is going to turn out, you are at least able to come home from the front to see your family. You find your father working in a field that up until now has belonged to a landowner who has beaten and starved your family for generations, manipulated the cost of food, raped your grandmothers, your mother, your aunts, your sisters, exported grain while you suffered famine. The power of that person, that vile person, which is rested in the land, has been taken away from him. It belongs to you now, and people like you. Imagine how that would feel. Imagine Trump without his towers. Imagine the maids, waiters, and greenskeepers taking over Mar-a-Lago. Just as amazing as what the decree on land did is the way that it did it, which exposes the lie that Lenin was or sought to be a dictator by demonstrating his deep commitment to democracy. Again, quoting Victor Serge, the anarchist turned Bolshevik, in drawing up the decree, Lenin took the wording from the 242 decrees which local peasant Soviets had passed in conformity with the agrarian program of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. This measure which the SRs had incessantly talked of, the Bolsheviks actually carried out. End quote. Lenin uses the words of the peasant Soviets to write the decree, essentially authorizing them to do what they had already decided to do. At the same time, he exposes the SRs as being more talk than action, causing them to lose leadership. As with the decree on peace, the decree on land draws criticism. It doesn't represent the Bolshevik party line. It doesn't call for collectivization. What it did do, however, was to unite the entirety of the peasantry, 80% of the population, who, rich or poor, had been serfs 50 years earlier, against the feudal landowners and behind the Soviets. Lenin replies to his critics in a typical fashion. Voices are being raised, he says, here that the decree itself and the mandate were drawn up by the socialist revolutionaries. What of it? Does it matter who drew them up? As a democratic government, we cannot ignore the decision of the masses of the people, even though we may disagree with it. In the fire of experience, applying the decree in practice, and carrying it out locally, the peasants will themselves realize where the truth lies. Experience is the best teacher, and it will show who is right. Now, before I discuss one last great decree, I want to draw your attention to the second page of the handout and the list of tasks that the new Soviet government accomplished between the 10th of November 2017 and the 3rd of January 2018, and it is titled, Who Says Nothing Can Happen Between Thanksgiving and New Year's? Everything from requisitioning warm clothes and abolishing ranks in the army, to instituting divorce, to enforcing the 8-hour day on the railroads, to opening peace talks at Brest-Litovsk. No rest for the Soviets. Hundreds of years of oppression undone in 2 months. Happy times. At the top of this list is the last decree I'm going to discuss, 10 November. Castes and the civil hierarchy were abolished. Now, as I mentioned, the Tsars had been in power for a long time, and the Tsar's social hierarchy was designed by Peter the Great in 1722. It established numerous classes and divided them all into grades. For example, in the civil class alone, there were 14 grades. The peasants and workers were, of course, at the very bottom of the social hierarchy. Now remember, It was normal, natural, for some people to be treated like dogs and for other people to treat them that way for 300 years. The provisional government shared power with the Soviets from February to October, the better part of a year, and did nothing to undermine this caste system. The Soviets abolished it on the 10th of November, less than 2 weeks after taking power. Now you would think that with all this going on, the Soviets wouldn't have time to do anything about culture, and you would be wrong. In fact, in November of 1917, just 1 month after taking power, the Bolsheviks set up the People's Commissariat for Education. Like the writers of the Great Decrees, the People's Commissariat for Education took their new power and got right to work. As John Reed described in 10 Days That Shook the World, the thirst for education, so long thwarted, burst with the revolution into a frenzy of expression. From Smolny Institute alone, the first 6 months went out every day, tons, carloads, trainloads of literature, saturating the land. Spending on education was increased by a factor of 10. Free access to education was mandated for all children ages 3 to 16. The number of schools was doubled, co-education was implemented, and schools for students with learning and other disabilities were created for the first time. Educational reforms included mass literacy campaigns, the institution of daycare and preschools so that mothers could focus on their education, and total redesigns of the schools themselves and their objectives, including an emphasis on self-activity, collectivism, and choice that drew on students' prior experience, knowledge, and interaction with the real world. Discipline in the new schools was organized and enacted by the students themselves. I wouldn't do that in my classroom. We haven't had a revolution yet. So. At the same time, university entrance exams were abolished, allowing workers to attend whatever lectures they wanted to for free. A general policy was instituted so that people who spoke languages other than Russian could teach and learn in their native tongues, a total departure from the Russian-only policies that preceded the revolution. And last but not least, the revolution inspired a wide range of innovative thinkers, such as Lev Vygotsky, the Mozart of psychology, to create educational theories that are relevant to this day. It's important to remember that these initiatives were accomplished despite vicious sabotage, desperate poverty, and a burgeoning civil war. To quote historian Ben Eklof, in 1920, the People's Commissariat for Education received the following six-month allotment: one pencil per 60 students, one pen per 22 students, one notebook for every two students. And in 1921, a brochure prepared by the Literacy Cheka included a chapter entitled, How to Get By Without Paper, Pencils, or Pens. I want you to take one final turn and talk before I move on to the last section, which is going to be on the Civil War, because although I intend to end on a high note, things are going to go downhill from here. Just so you know. So please discuss for a few minutes the accomplishments of the Revolution and or, and this is what I think most of you should focus on, what previously seemingly impossible things would you accomplish if you were to suddenly find yourself in power? Okay? Take two minutes. So those of you unfamiliar with the history of the Russian Revolution might be wondering how, after all the accomplishments I laid out above, everything went to pieces. The answer to that question is sabotage and civil war. The chapter in which Serge discusses sabotage is entitled The Urban Middle Classes Against the Proletariat. But many of the people he considers middle class work in jobs that we would consider working class. Nevertheless, these workers, teachers, engineers, municipal employees, did not identify with the mass of the Russian workers. In Moscow and Petrograd in 1917, these professionalized workers happened to be situated at many of the pressure points of the new government, and like a Gracie grappler, they knew exactly how to put on the pain. According to Serge, 16,000 municipal employees greeted the success of the revolution by going on strike. According to John Reed, all of the government employees went on strike. The post and telegraph employees union would not deliver mail or transmit telegrams for the Soviets. The railway workers union, the same people who had ripped up the tracks to keep Kornilov out of Petrograd, they refused to transport the Soviets. And it wasn't just that these skilled and educated workers did not identify with the majority of the working class. It was also that what Serge called the counter-revolutionary Democrats, the moderate and conservative socialists, those same people who walked out of the Soviets when they lost their majority, were teaming up with the bourgeois parties to undermine the new government. With their encouragement, banks hid their money, businesses and government ministries locked out their workers, destroyed their records, and broke their own machinery. Given this state of affairs, to paraphrase Lenin, miracles of proletarian organization had to be achieved. Quoting Serge, this idea of Lenin's provided the key to people's salvation. The many-headed resistance of entire classes could be combated only by the initiative of masses more numerous and more energetic. In this period, the policy of the Soviet authority consisted principally in awakening, stimulating, sometimes guiding, but more usually simply of endorsing the initiative of the masses. That is, the fact of this sabotage, which got in the way of Soviets paying wages to workers, feeding refugees, and maintaining public utilities, the supporters of the Soviets redoubled their efforts. In the words of John Reed, couriers came and went, running or in commandeered automobiles, and commissars, common soldiers, workmen, armed with the power of life and death, invested with the authority of the risen proletariat, dashed out to the four corners of the city, to the front, and all vast Russia, to command, plead, argue, and fight. Whenever they could, the Soviets answered the strikes by meeting their demands. But it was hard, and difficult choices had to be made. In order to end the war with Germany, the Soviet government negotiated and signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which involved many sacrifices, most of which I will not be able to cover, but I want to spend some time talking about what happened in Finland, because it demonstrates why the Bolsheviks fought so desperately to hold on to power once they had it, and was no doubt very much in the minds of the Soviet representatives in their dealings with the so-called moderate socialists. Unlike Russia, Finland was an advanced country, both economically and politically. Though it became a part of the Russian Empire in 1809, all attempts at Russification were met with resistance, and the Tsar was forced to grant the country a constitution after the 1905 revolution. 2 years later, the Finns instituted universal suffrage, and it was really universal, like women were included too, which oftentimes when they say it's universal, it's not actually, because it doesn't include women. By 1916, they had voted in the 8-hour workday, and Social Democrats held an absolute majority in the Sejm, or parliament. If any country could vote its way to socialism, it would have been Finland. However, the situation was not tolerable to the Finnish ruling class. From the beginning of World War I, the Finnish bourgeoisie had been planning to use the conflict as a cover for reasserting its power, through civil war if necessary. To make this happen, they did everything from contributing troops to the German army, to organizing secret military training schools, to producing the first ever White Guards. They also committed voting fraud in order to reverse the Social Democrats' majority in the Sejm. In November, the October Revolution in Russia was echoed in Finland with a massive and successful general strike, and the situation came to a crisis point that could have been resolved with workers taking power. However, as one of the leaders of the Finnish Social Democrats, O.W. Kosinen, later wrote, "Wishing not to risk our democratic conquests and hoping to maneuver around this turning point of history with our parliamentary skill, we decided to evade the revolution. We did not believe in the revolution. We reposed no hope in it. We had no wish for it." According to Serge, their aim was to establish, without the appropriation of the rich or the dictatorship of labor, a parliamentary democracy in which the proletariat would have been the leading class. Consequently, rather than a workers' takeover, the strike is followed by the introduction of a bourgeois cabinet presided over by a reactionary named Svinhufvud. And I don't speak Finnish, but I speak Swedish, and if the two languages are all the same, that literally means pig head. That was his name. Soon after, the Finnish Social Democrats realize that they will have to fight to maintain their democratic conquests. Not long after that, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk is signed, and most of the Russian troops that have been guarding Finland against German invasion are evacuated. They have to go. And only 1,000 or so Russian Red Guards stay behind to help organize the newly formed Finnish Red Guards. The Social Democrats' preparations for class war are not sufficient to stave off the white onslaught that follows. And as a consequence, and this is a quote, "the massacre of the socialists reached such a scale that people lost all interest in the topic. Tens of thousands of ordinary Finns, men, women, and children, are killed outright, while 70,000 are placed in concentration camps to die slowly." Serge characterizes the massacre as follows: "The white terror is not to be explained by the frenzy of battle, the violence of class hatred, or any other psychological factor. The terror is, in reality, the result of a calculation and historical necessity. The victorious property classes are perfectly aware that they can only ensure their own domination in the aftermath of a social battle by inflicting on the working class a bloodbath savage enough to enfeeble it for tens of years afterwards. And since the class in question is far more numerous than the wealthy classes, the number of victims must be very great." Meanwhile, back in Russia, the same Brest-Litovsk Treaty that took the Russian troops out of Finland bought the new Soviet government the time that it needed to keep its promise of peace, demobilize the army, and establish the gains outlined above, all in anticipation of revolution in Germany, which seems at the time likely, if not imminent. As Lenin put it in the political report of the Central Committee from the extraordinary 7th Congress of the Russian Communist Party, formerly the Bolsheviks, on March 6th through 8th, 1918, "The German Revolution is growing, but not in the way we should like it, not as fast as the Russian intellectuals would have it, and not at the rate our history developed in October. When we entered any town we liked, proclaimed Soviet power, and within a few days, 9/10 of the workers came over to our side. The German Revolution has the misfortune of not moving so fast. But it is the absolute truth that without a German Revolution, we are doomed. At all events, under all conceivable circumstances, if the German Revolution does not come, we are doomed. Nevertheless, this does not in the least shake our conviction that we must be able to bear the most difficult position without blustering." And people know that the German Revolution did not actually. Then, just as the Soviets are getting a handle on things, they're faced with invasion and civil war, organized by the capitalist states of the world, which previously had been fighting against each other in World War I, but somehow find a way to forget their differences and work together to try and crush the revolution. In Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution, Todd Creation includes a retrospective of the revolution, which was written by Albert Rees Williams, who was a Congregational minister and American journalist. Williams' account of the Civil War demonstrates the inhuman viciousness of the capitalist countries that organized the counter-revolution, whose armies, once defeated, quote, "turned their retreat into an orgy of destruction. With torch and dynamite, they laid waste the land, leaving behind a black wake of ruin and ashes." It was in the context of this vicious external assault, in combination with a fresh wave of famine, that control over the Soviets became concentrated in the hands of the Communist Party members. It was not part of a plan, but the result of a series of pragmatic responses to practical problems. For example, the disarmament and then suppression of the anarchists, whose organizations, which tended to be armed, had been infiltrated, by their own admission, by, quote, suspicious elements, common criminals, and counter-revolutionaries. General Goppers, a member of the counter-revolutionary Fatherland and Freedom Defense League, put it this way: the anarchist clubs gave us the opportunity of organizing ourselves properly. They were tolerated by the Bolsheviks. At the beginning of April, 60 or 70 of our members were installed in these clubs. That is, the looseness of the anarchist organization, which was dictated by their political principles, turned them into havens for counter-revolutionary activity, and so they were disarmed and suppressed. It is noteworthy that at this point, the suppression of the anarchists consisted of short jail terms for white infiltrators posing as anarchists, as well as the anarchists themselves. As Serge describes it, the counter-revolutionary officers who were arrested during the disarmament of the anarchists only had to play out their roles patiently in order to be liberated at the end of several weeks. The concentration of power in the hands of the communists is made complete when the left SRs commit political suicide by assassinating a high-ranking German prisoner of war, declaring themselves the only governing party, and demanding the ripping up of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which, as it turns out, was directly against the wishes of their base. At this point, the task of defending Soviet control, however diminished in its democratic character, and preventing a repeat of what happened in Finland becomes the principal objective, leading to a number of qualitative shifts. Got it. Thank you. That's better than I thought.
Yeah.
Famine and local anarchy. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm quoting Serge describing the qualitative shifts. Famine and local anarchy compel a rigorous concentration of powers in the hands of the appropriate commissariats. The catastrophe of the transport system compels a recourse to draconic methods of authority on the railways. The war, the total encirclement of the revolution, and the inadequacy of spontaneous foci of resistance compel the establishment of a regular army to supplement and supplant guerrilla formations. Conspiracy compels the introduction of powerful apparatus of internal defense. Assassinations, peasant risings, and the mortal danger compel the use of terror. With the disappearance of political debates between parties representing different social interests through the various shades of their opinions, Soviet institutions now function in a vacuum. Since all decisions are taken by the party, all they can do is give them the official rubber stamp. At this point, I want to take a step back, although I'm not going to let you guys talk again, and point out a few things. The implosion of the left SRs happens in July of 1918. The victory of the revolution is still less than a year old, and the events I'm summarizing are occurring over vast tracts of land and involve millions of people, all with their individual dreams and desires, and all in the context of persistent hunger. Behind and around all the dramatic actions I've described are ordinary people striving to eat, to make things work, to convince themselves and each other of the rightness of their actions. It is difficult to get your mind around it. And that is why I really recommend that everybody read Serge's book, read Todd Kreshen's book, Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution, and read China Miéville's October, so you can get a real flavor of what went on. That said, of the qualitative changes I just outlined, I'm only going to get to discuss one, the Red Terror. I would like to discuss the formation of the regular army, but I don't have time for that, so please ask about it during discussion. It's a really good story. I want to differentiate the Red Terror from the White Terror on two points. Number one, although it was eventually institutionalized through law and an executive body, the Cheka, it was not from the outside centralized or carried out with the same calculation as the White Terror, as outlined by Serge above. And number two, because the Soviets represented the majority, its ferocity and extent were limited. So, for example, the assassination of the Romanovs, the Tsar and his family, was carried out, firstly, due to the advance of Czech troops that were fighting on the side of the whites, and secondly, at the insistence, not of the all-Russian Congress of Soviets, let alone the Central Committee of the Communist Party, or Lenin or Trotsky, but of the Ural Soviet and some anarchists and left SRs, who were so mistrustful of the Bolsheviks' ability to carry out the task that they plotted to carry out the executions themselves. People were not, even the Romanovs, who are this horrible, like brutal ruling family, there's no eagerness on the part of the central government to kill them, right? It gets done sort of like on the outskirts. According to Serge, quote, the Bureau of the All-Russian Executive learned of the Romanovs' execution during its session on the 18th of July. A draft decree on public health was being discussed when the announcement was made by Yakov Sverdlov. Quote, I have been informed that Nicholas has been shot at Ekaterinburg on the order of the Regional Soviet. Nicholas wanted to escape. The Czechoslovaks were approaching. The Bureau of the Jiček approves. The advance of the Czechs, interesting timing for the applause, the advance of the Czechs, meanwhile, meant the end of Soviet rule in the region of the Volga, the institution of SR-led constituent assemblies, and the protracted massacre of communists and suspects. For several days, Serge writes, the streets were strewn with disfigured, undressed corpses, just like in Finland. Meanwhile, the famine continues unabated, and the cities empty out because food is easier to acquire in the countryside. This further undermines the base of Soviet power, and more qualitative changes are instituted. In Petrograd, all bourgeois publications are now suppressed. Now please note, this is August of 2018, 10 months after the Soviets took power. During this whole time, the ruling class has been free to organize counter-revolution through its legal periodicals. But at this point, mass arrests of known and suspected counter-revolutionaries began. And on August 18th, Zinoviev, one of the Bolsheviks, as chairman of the Council of People's Commissars of the Northern Commune, publishes a warning that enemies of the Republic would from now on be executed.
The weapon of the terror is now ready, Serge writes. But it will be used by the revolution only after the attempts at assassination that are at this moment being planned. The assassination attempts are on Lenin and Trotsky. Trotsky is in the midst of mustering a regular army, which is desperately necessary to defend the revolution from the whites. And Lenin's value to the revolution is undisputed. The assassination attempts produce, in Serge's words, a terrible wave of fury in the party and the proletariat. The feeling was that the moment of reckoning had now come, in which the revolution had no alternative but to destroy or be destroyed. Hundreds of counter-revolutionaries, nobles, and sympathizers are summarily shot or taken hostage. But for the reasons outlined above, the Red Terror is far less bloody than the White Terror, and in Trotsky's words, quote, is not to be distinguished in principle from the armed insurrection, of which it is no more than a continuation, end quote. A statement that definitely warrants discussion. But it is interesting to me how differently the Red Terror is treated by mainstream historians than, say, the Jacobin Terror. Both were bloody and provoked by foreign intervention, but no mainstream historian argues that the French Revolution was a mistake. In any case, all of this was going on in the interest of protecting the revolution from foreign invasion and civil war. The workers would eventually win the battle. Unfortunately, it would be at the cost of half of the working class, further eroding the Soviets' democratic base and enabling Stalin's rise to power. A return to Albert Rees Williams's description of the Civil War, however, suggests how close the Russian workers came to securing the long-term success of the revolution. The Allied troops, quote, fought half-heartedly. They mutinied. The whites, in tens of thousands, whole battalions and ambulance corps, came over to the revolution. One after another, the armies of the counter-revolution crumpled, were melted away like snow in a Russian spring. The great steel cordon tightening around the revolution was smashed to bits. And the worker and peasant soldiers of Russia accomplished this without any outside aid, without the success of revolutions in Germany, England, or Austria, or the support of their more developed economies. Quite the opposite. To quote Williams again, to these famished, frozen, typhus-stricken Russians sailed no ships of goodwill, laden with books, tools, teachers, and engineers, but grim ships of war and transports laden with troops and officers, guns, and poison gas. Now I want you to imagine the hardest day of your life, a day when you just didn't want to do anything, not even get out of bed. Then again, imagine yourself as a soldier in Russia in 1918 and turn that feeling up to 11. You've been treated like a dog your whole life and then sent off to die on a hideous, horrible battlefield, freezing, hungry, barefoot. Your wounds are wrapped in newspaper. And then the war ends, and you barely have a chance to celebrate before you have to jump back into the trenches to defend the government that ended the war. What could motivate you to do that? This is what I've been pondering since I read Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution. What could spark the self-activity of a working class pushed halfway, maybe three-quarters of the way, to death by famine, sabotage, and war? The only explanation that makes sense to me is that they were motivated by the feeling they got from taking power. The exhausted soldiers, who couldn't be threatened, beaten, or cajoled into fighting one more day for Mother Russia, took up arms willingly, feverishly, to defend the revolution. Their revolution. They felt what it was like to command their own destinies, to end oppression and strike great blows against inequality, to do real good in the world, and found strength where there had been none. I personally have no idea what that feels like, but I want to know. And the closest I can get to that feeling is to read about the Russian Revolution, to get as close as the printed word will allow to the men and women who made it happen. The capitalist ruling class is short-sighted when it comes to looking toward the future, but it takes a long view on the past. It doesn't forget, and it doesn't forgive. Look what it has done and continues to do to Haiti for daring to have a successful revolution that abolished slavery 70 years before the U.S. ruling class was willing to even imagine giving it up. That same ruling class will never forgive the workers of Russia for successfully challenging its power, for demonstrating that a vastly different and more humane way of life is possible. So it is up to us to learn, preserve, and promote the real history of the Russian Revolution. I hope that today I have inspired you, at least a little, to make that your project.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.